No WAF PLS, plus.
I don't know. I feel like it should be PLZ.
PLZ? I think you're stuck in 2012, bro. I don't know. Nobody says PLZ anymore.
What? No, does no one say PLZ?
No, it's
Am I showing my millennial here?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You're old. You're old, dude. Outdated. Hey everyone, this is TechnoGeek here. Just wanted to give a quick shout out to our latest sponsor, Project Discovery. Now, Project Discovery makes a lot of tools that you probably know of or have even used. One of them is Nuclei, and the latest release of Nuclei is version 3.2. Now, 3.2 comes with a lot of really awesome new features. Two that I really wanted to highlight here for you are the authenticated scanning and the advanced fuzzing support. Now, for authenticated scanning, it used to be that you would have to do all your Nuclei scanning against unauthenticated endpoints, or you'd have to add your cookies manually, all that kind of messy. No more. It's all automatic. You can use existing login templates to automatically log in to your application, and then you can run all your existing Nuclei templates against an authenticated part of the application now to really increase your coverage. The other that I mentioned is advanced fuzzing support. Now, Nuclei had added way back in version 2.8 the ability to fuzz different things, but now they've expanded this comprehensively across the board. So not only can you fuzz in the normal spots, but you can fuzz within headers, you can fuzz within cookies, you can fuzz within specific parts of the body, whether that's in JSON or XML or form data, and so many more things. So if you want to learn more about what came in Nuclei 3.2, go ahead and check out the release blog post over at nux.gg/podcast. That's nux.gg/podcast. Thanks.
All right, Joel, how are you feeling about these bad boys right here?
Those, well, I mean, it matches your eyes, man. It's good.
What do you mean it matches my eyes? They're bright pink. I left, for those of you listening, I left my headphones in the car this week and I don't have them right now. So I stole my wife's bright pink Bose headphones right now that I'm doing this pod with. So, you know, the devotion to the pod. Am I right?
Very, very stylish. Very stylish.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Whew, man, that NahumCon weekend, that was a blast, dude.
Yeah, that was super awesome. I don't think many people would think that we sort of threw that together last minute, but
yeah,
that was very on the fly sort of setup that we had going on there. It looked great through the camera. Behind it was just like chaos.
Chaos. Well, you know, we have been known we were going to host NahumCon for a while, but we kind of last minute decided, hey, let's do it together in person because I wanted to go see Joel's new house anyway. And yeah, dude, it worked out pretty well. We said, all right, we've got an hour to put together a studio for this whole thing, and Naham got the setups individualized again for one person versus two, and it went through. So that was pretty great.
Yeah, it was awesome.
All right, dude, we're gonna do a quick one today because it's a long weekend. We got some busy stuff going on. But I did want to go through a couple things that I've been thinking about lately. And one of them is freaking Johan Carlson calling me out on Twitter because I didn't know about the question mark dot syntax. Do you know about the question mark dot syntax?
I didn't. I mean, I didn't know that JavaScript supported this. I've seen this in a lot of other languages, so mm-hmm. I guess I'm not surprised, but I am a little surprised. It's super interesting. It like basically is like a if not null, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a optional chaining operator. And I think that this is mostly used when you're like trying to figure out if there's multiple layers of elements in place, like sub attributes on an object. But it's also possible to use this in between a function name and the, you know, sort of whatever these bad boys are, the parentheses that you use to call a function. And so I wasn't aware of that. And I comment on this post on Twitter. I'm like, oh, wow, I'm kind of surprised this worked. And then freaking Johan Carlson comes in there and says, I'm surprised that you're surprised, good sir. It's a valid operator. And I'm like, okay, listen here, Johan. I know you're listening to this. you know, I bring you on my podcast and now you're calling me out on Twitter. No, he's right. I probably should have known about that. And I think it's really useful for anybody who's dealing with WAFs in any capacity, because I think not a lot of WAFs are anticipating a question mark and a dot to be in between a function name and the function call parentheses. So I think it's a good one to be aware of.
Yeah, that's a super good one to have in your back pocket. And speaking of WAF bypasses, No WAF Plus is the new tool from AssetNote. So AssetNote/Shubs launched this tool called No WAF PLS Plus.
I don't know. I feel like it should be PLZ.
PLZ. I think you're stuck in 2012, bro. I don't know. Nobody says PLZ anymore.
What? No, does no one say PLZ?
No, it's
am I showing my millennial here?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You're old, dude. All outdated.
Right. Lovely. Thank you for that. But the tool is good.
Yeah, this thing is awesome. I mean, TLDR is all the different techniques and stuff that were in the talk for, you know, different methods and bypasses to different WAFs are incorporated within this tool to help you bypass WAFs, you know, so WAF Plus.
And it's all pretty simple too. I mean, all it is, I wrote the Kaito version for it. And essentially what it does is it adds a bunch of padding to your request. So if it's a, you know, URL encoded content type, then it just adds like A equals A, you know, jump like sometimes up to 100 megabytes of A's and then your actual content, right? But sometimes it's as low as 8 kilobytes that you'll need to bypass these WAFs that are just like, 8 kilobytes, that's too big. We can't process that. And then moves along. So it was pretty easy to build in Kaito. It doesn't have all the features. You know, you've got to go into the workflow and manually set the kilobyte size of padding that you want. But it should do the job to bypass most WAFs. And I just love the simplicity of this whole technique because it's just like, all right, throw a bunch of garbage in there. And then the WAF says, uh-oh, I don't know what to do with that. Go ahead.
Such a crazy technique. I mean, it seems so simple, but at the same time, you're like, wow, I can't believe that works.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. I'm with you on that one. all right. So, like I said, we're gonna move along pretty quickly today because it's a tight weekend for us. But this next one that I actually do, I don't know, man. Maybe this needs a little bit more discussion, but I did want to at least shout it out. I am D3D. On Twitter tweeted out something about a entire report being redacted by a customer on BugCrowd. And I've also seen this on HackerOne as well, where your entire report will just get deleted from HackerOne. And it won't be like deleted, but the whole thing will be redacted. And there's just no way to access your own vuln report. And I feel like this is pretty whack. And the explanations from the various programs have been kind of a miss, I think. What are your thoughts on this bad boy?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get into it too much. I think it's certainly very interesting, like, that they can do that. I totally see why they might want to do that, because, like, it is their IP, I guess, right? Like, you know, the vulnerability itself and, like, all the information disclosed within it. So it's a tricky situation for sure. I don't know. You know, at the end of the day, you are handing the vulnerability over. So if that's something that you're concerned about, you can always just like keep a local copy of all your reports. But yeah, you know, nothing stops you from doing that. But yeah, I mean, the company does sort of have the right to, you know, because they have full edit. You know, when the report like goes into the program, like it's in their inbox. They control everything on the report. They can change the title. They can do whatever, right? So like, you know, there's some level of sort of ownership over that.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear that. I just think it's also a place for the hackers to store their vulnerabilities in like a history of what vulnerabilities you found, or like maybe you want those pieces of information in there so you can go back later and like check those techniques, or maybe even check for regressions, right? That's a pretty common thing that we do, is go back, look at all the reports we found, and then see if those fixes that haven't put in place have been undone, and so you can get another vulnerability. So I think it's a little tricky. I think there's maybe a tool opportunity here, a top opportunity, so to speak, is what I called.
Topportunity.
A Topportunity, a tool opportunity.
Oh, well, that one, man.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm spinning on the fly today. So I think it'd be cool to have a tool that just runs on a cron job on your VPS. Just make it super simple. All you do is give it the input, like access token or API token for HackerOne or for BugCrowd, and then it just pulls all your reports down and creates a backup of them. And yep. I think that would be really valuable.
Yeah, you can export reports pretty easily, I believe.
Mm, yeah, you can. That's true. So it shouldn't be very hard to code either. But then it can't be like continuously updating, because if they go in and be and like redact it, and then you overwrite your, you know, normal copy with a redacted copy, then you're kind of screwed. So you kind of got to know which one you've already pulled, and then only pull those ones.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. So I think that would be cool. I would run that on my VPS. It does make your VPS a little bit more of a yeah, it does make your VPS a little bit more of a target, though. Maybe I'll run that on like a cron job on my local server at my house, and just have it like back up to like a you know, external drive or something like that, so it's not out there on the internet. That just kind of gives me the EBGBs a little bit.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. All right, man. Let's see. We got the sort of recap from Johan Carlson's XSS challenge, which I think was pretty cool. Or we can go and talk about this Matan Bear tweet. Let's go into that one, because this one's kind of interesting, right? Take a look at this. This is a tweet that Matan Bear retweeted, so it's not even from him. He just brought it to my attention. But the tweet says this. There is a popular opinion bad cores like access control allow origin star is unexploitable. That's the popular opinion, I think. The browsers won't send a cookie in this case. It is delusional. Which is, or it is a delusion, is what it says. You can exploit it with a Chrome cache feature. One, I just love how strongly worded that is. Like, this is delusional. But two, I think there's an interesting technique here, which is that he's saying that you can exploit this with Chrome's cache feature. And the little infographic that it says here is cores like access control origin star may be useless at first sight because you can't send cookies with it, but Chrome caches get responses without the cache control null store header by default for 2 days. And then you can leak the response of this by using force cache method along with fetch. And then that will send if you know the URL that was cached, you can send a request out, you can force it to use the cache, and it will pull that cached version back. And since it has access control allow origin star, it will actually allow you to read that response, which I think is pretty cool. But something makes me say that this got fixed at some point. Did you ever hear anything about that?
I mean, I'm not enough of like a web guy. I would consider myself, like, when it comes to like the nitty gritty of this kind of stuff, I am, my finger is not on the pulse enough. So I definitely didn't. But it's super interesting. I mean, these are like, I feel like if I were to go exploit an XSS nowadays, I would hit so many of these like weird things. I'd be like, I would not even be able to like compete.
Yeah, the access control, the core stuff, I think, is a little bit tricky sometimes. But I want to say that this, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I want to say that this technique is fixed. So I'm gonna pause it, and I'm gonna go check it right now. Hey guys, real quick, I just wanted to give a shout to the Hacker Content team. They have been absolutely killing it the past couple months, taking the content from the podcast and condensing it down into consumable social media posts, whether it be shorts or text posts or whatever. They've been rocking it. So I just wanted to give them a shout out and let you know that they do all sorts of cybersecurity content as well as social media management. They do technical blogs. They do comprehensive social media management. So if your organization could benefit from any of those types of services, make sure you head over to hackercontent.com, drop them a line, and mention the podcast when you do to get your first month of cybersecurity content marketing services for free. All right, that's it. Let's get back to the pod. All right, dude, I investigated that real quick. And actually, I knew that that sounded familiar to me when I put the notes in the doc. Yeah, it is fixed. But I thought it was a really interesting exploit when it first came out or when I first saw it, I was first introduced with it or a little bit earlier on. And I think that there are probably other opportunities like that with force cache in place. But I just wanted to also kind of put that out there as well, that this, it does not appear that this technique works, at least with my current setup that I went.
Well, and if I could throw a little shameless plug in here, you know, we have this channel called Intent to Ship. That's
true.
It's available to our critical thinkers. And I feel like something like this would probably show up in there if it were to change. So if you're a subscriber on our Discord and you're one of the critical thinkers, then you'll have access to this and you'll probably know ahead of time.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I wish I had that Discord channel whenever they fixed this in the first place, because I would have been able to keep up to date with that. Also, I will say though that we only are currently pulling the stuff for Blink in there, but there's also the rendering engine that Firefox uses, which I believe is called Gecko or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
So I'm gonna update that bot as well soon to include the stuff from Gecko so that we can stay on top of all of that as well. You know, for whatever measly share of users Firefox represents at this point.
yeah. What is it, like 2%?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. All right. So a couple more things I wanted to go through here. The next one. Okay, dude, did you see freaking Johan's CTF with the sandbox iframe?
No, I didn't.
It was kind of crazy, actually, dude. I was looking at it for a while, and there's a couple pieces to it. One of them is like a CSP bypass. It utilizes the fact that like you can redirect from a domain that is, like, if you have a path-based CSP in place for script source. So let's say you whitelist like technogeek.io/okjavascript, right? Mm-hmm. And a user can actually host JavaScript at technogeek.io/badjavascript or whatever. If you can make a redirect from okay JavaScript to bad JavaScript, then it will trust that redirection.
Okay.
And so that was one of the cool things, one of the cool hacks that he had in place for that CTF. But the one that really kind of blew my mind was this whole concept of essentially you can escape a sandbox inside of an iframe and leak the base URI of the top level frame with no relationship to that frame, you know, with no like allow same origin or anything like that. And the sandboxing thing sort of works by defining a null origin for that frame and then trust same origin policy to sort of make sure that you can't access the data in a different frame. But what Johan figured out was when a source doc is used in iframe in conjunction with that sandbox, that you can access the document.base URI property. And what that will do is it will give you the URI that is associated with the top level document, not the sandbox document, because of the source doc, I think being different than the actual source.
That's super interesting.
In the iframe. Yeah. And so essentially what you could do is you could have a sandboxed iframe, origin null, no ability to do anything besides run scripts, and you can leak the top, you know, window location.href of the top frame, which will lead to a bunch of really cool bugs, I think, but it sounds most impactful in an environment where you can like essentially land an OAuth code on that top level path and then go from your sandboxed iframe up and grab that OAuth code and exfiltrate it.
Super, super cool. That's really interesting. I love these little mini CTFs that keep coming out. The like XSS challenges and stuff. I feel like they disappeared for a while, but it's good. It hones your skills. You know, they're real world problems a lot of the time. Like this almost certainly came from a real vulnerability that he had to exploit. And he was sitting there, he's like, I wonder how many other people could exploit this.
Exactly. Well, I'm also interested because it's like iframe source doc, which is the, you know, alternative to a source for an iframe. You can provide a source doc and actually just write the HTML code right directly inside the attribute. I feel like it's a pretty rare thing to see, but I could also see this happening a lot in like e-commerce environments or something like that, where you need to be able to provide some customization to the environment while still actually not letting the user get access to like credit card data and stuff like that. So I think there's lots of applications for this. How often SourceDoc is actually used, I can't say though, because I've pretty much mostly just seen the source attribute used if you're defining an iframe.
Yeah.
I think it's easier to do it that way too, because then you don't have to worry about like Base64 encoding the whole thing or like, you know, sticking it inside the source doc. So it's a little bit of a niche thing, but that's what we're all about here. These sort of niche edge cases. So if you guys see source doc defined instead of source on an iframe, make sure you keep this trick in mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, dude, let's see. Let's take a look at some of these other ones here. Okay. This one is exciting. Okay. Let me just say this one. Okay. There was a blog post that I think we've talked about a little bit before that came out, iframe and window.open. It was from blog.huli.tw. Yeah. And I read through a lot of it and I was a little bit disappointed to see that there was a technique that had been sort of, you know, cards close to the chest, wasn't really talking about this one quite as much. That got disclosed there. So I figured, all right, let me just go ahead and talk about it. And that technique is, once again, regarding sandbox iframes. And essentially what happens here, Joel, is when you define a sandboxed iframe, you can define a set of like sandbox attributes associated with it, right? You can say like, all right, allow script, allow pop-up, allow modal, allow same origin. You've got all these like options, right?
Yep.
What's really cool is that if you do a window.open from that sandboxed iframe, that window that results in, you know, that pops up in your browser in a new tab, that bad boy will also have those same properties that the sandboxed iframe has. So then you get into this weird scenario where I can define an iframe on my page that has the sandboxed attributes, and you click a button on there and it opens up a new tab on joel.com. And now joel.com has those, and my cookies are sent to joel.com, everything. It's like a full top level nav. But the origin of that page is set to null. So it's not set to the normal like top level joel.com thing. So if I were to try to access the source of that page from a, or communicate with that page from another null origin iframe, then you could do communications if the, if the post message handler or whatever you're working with here checks window.origin or origin. If it says event.origin, so event being the post message that's being sent, equals window.origin, which is a very common code pattern to check whether the message is coming from the current page that you're on or not, then it will allow communication. But what we can do now is we can change that origin on joel.com or bank.com or whatever to null.
Yeah.
And then communicate with that iframe from another null origin iframe.
That's really interesting. That's a really interesting technique. And it still works?
It does. It still works.
Or it checks now? Oh, okay.
No, it works. I mean, I think it's just a function of how it works. Yeah, dude. I was kind of like kept on looking for opportunities to use it. And I had an opportunity one time where it was going to work out so good. And there was just this one little like teeny tiny mitigating factor where I couldn't get it to actually work. But because it is inside of a sandboxed iframe, you have a bunch of other restrictions. So it's not like it doesn't like break the whole internet. But it will allow, because you can't make requests out, you know, you can't do a bunch of other stuff because of the sandbox. But what you can do is you can access any data that's loaded onto that page. So if you're able to like open up a page that says, hello, Joel, or whatever, with authorized user, since your cookies were sent with that original top level navigation, you can actually leak the data that's on that page and exfiltrate it out. So,
dang.
Definitely another cool technique.
That's a cool bug, man.
I can't recommend enough going to this, you know, blog.tuli or huli.tw and reading this blog post. It's a really high quality one if you want to understand same origin policy and the ways that frames communicate.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good one, man. all right. I know we've got a little bit, we only got a little bit longer today. Let me look at some of these other ones. Okay. Let me give you an option here because we can't get through all of these. Do you want to have me talk about a plugin, a Chrome plugin that I think really needs more attention? Or do you want me to talk about a technique that really, you know what? I'm going to go with the second one. It's more in line with the topic. Okay. Everybody, I'm just going to say this. Go check out DOM Logger PP if you haven't already. That is going to be a very pivotal tool, I think, in the future of web, of client web security.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that thing, and it looks pretty crazy, man.
It's pretty awesome. Yeah. And I think it allows you to do your due diligence on client side stuff very well.
Nice.
Joel, let me run this last one by you, okay? So this concept, iframe hijacking, I think is really consistent with the stuff that we're talking about here. And we've talked about it, I think, once before on the pod, but we haven't talked about it super thoroughly. And it's this concept, okay? You have a page, like, for example, an OAuth flow that will do a window.open, right? It's going to pop up like a little box or something like that, you know, click prove or whatever, blah, 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 right? Mm-hmm. And then it's going to communicate from that little box back to the main page that opened it up. Pretty common flow, right?
Yep.
Yeah, you see it all over the place.
Yep.
Here's the thing. You can hijack that little box. And the way you do that is if the page that does the window.open, if it supplies the name of the frame that it will be opening that up in, which most of the time they do, then what you can do is you can create a page or an iframe on your attacker-controlled page. And you can put that iframe to be the same origin of the page that will be opening up the new pop-up. So if it's on like, you know, login.whatever.com, then you set it to like login.whatever.com/404 or something like that. Something that's iframeable. You know, you want to try to find, maybe it's like an icon or something and they forgot the, you know, iframe not allowed or xframe options header. And you can embed it into your page. You set it to that.
Okay.
And then you name that iframe the name of the window that they're going to window.open on this other page. And so what's going to happen when they click on the link in the page that you want to attack is it will say, it'll look through the tab group and it'll say, hey, is there any frame that exists in our little like circle of frames here that has this name? Mm-hmm. And if so, I'm going to open into that. And so what it does is it identifies the frame that you set up in your page, and it will actually open up that website into that frame. Okay. So okay. now it says, okay, I've just opened up this page. You know, the user is going to be like authorizing stuff, blah, 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 blah. I'm going to trust that pop-up that happened, right? But really it wasn't a pop-up. It went to that iframe. Now, since we put that iframe in our own page, we can redirect that iframe to whatever we want. We can redirect it to an attacker-controlled page.
Yeah, and do you get a window reference back from that too?
You do, yeah. Because it's, you know, you created the iframe, so you can go ahead and you know, everything looks fine and dandy to the victim side where they did the window.open. And since you have the iframe on your page, you can easily get a window reference through that. Hmm. And so then, you know, you can redirect that page to a malicious page. You can just bypass the whole flow and inject your attacker controlled credentials there, right? A lot of times what will happen is they'll do like an auth callback to a specific page, and then there will be data in the hash, and because it'll be same origin, it'll reach in and grab that data. Well, you can just redirect it to the same origin and then inject your own data in the hash. Mm. And then now you're controlling the flow of the application. And I call this bad boy frame hijacking. I think it's a lot of things are vulnerable to this. And the main takeaway here is make sure whenever you see a pop-up happening or some change happening in an iframe, look to see the window.open call that's doing it and check the name on that. Because if it is using a name that is guessable, then you may be able to hijack that iframe and gain control of the flow in that specific scenario.
Mm, that's really, really interesting.
Does all that make sense? I know I kind of sounded like that guy with like the strings and like the map, like, you know?
I think I followed you though. Yeah, that's pretty freaking sweet. You just have it's a browser behavior though. Like
it is. And it's only in Chrome.
Mm, okay. That's super interesting. So you can have two windows with the same name in Firefox?
It seems like that's the case, right? Because in Firefox, it doesn't open it up, and the window.open would then trigger and open up a new window. And I don't know why it doesn't work in Firefox, because they're in the same tab group. It seems like that should be compliant with the spec, but maybe they make some sort of differentiation because, you know, your frame is sort of sandwiched in between the two. And it's, I don't know, it just doesn't work in Firefox for some reason.
Yeah, that's super weird.
It also doesn't work in incognito tab in Chrome, which is weird. So there's some weird restrictions that are going on there.
Huh. I guess I wonder if it's just because of the anti-tracking stuff.
The anti-tracking stuff has been getting in the way a lot lately. I don't know what Chrome did recently with that, but anytime there's a use of an iframe, something weird is happening.
That's super weird.
Yeah. All right, man. That's pretty much all I had for today. I won't go into the whole spiel about the Domlogger PP, but it's a really cool thing, so definitely go check it out. You got anything else you wanted to shout before we move along?
I think that's it, man.
All right, sweet. It'll be a short one today, but you know, we're staying consistent for you guys, the listeners, even though it's a busy week. So hopefully you guys get a lot out of this whole iframe mess that we described today.
Yeah, lots of new tools, lots of new techniques to dig into in your free time.
Indeed. In the time that you are spending not listening to this episode of Critical Thinking, go and read that blog post about frames in window.open. We'll link it
absolutely
down below.
Absolutely. All
right. Peace, guys.
Peace.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.